Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about how we talk to people who are different from us and how understanding the things that we and others hold sacred might help us do that better. In this episode, you'll hear me talking to Neil Griffiths. Neil is a British novelist and the founder of the Republic of Consciousness Prize for Small Presses. He was the winner of the Authors Club First Novel Award and has been shortlisted for Best Novel in the Costa Book Awards. His most recent novel is As a God Might Be, which follows the journey of Proctor McCulloch. Mac, as he's known, is a middle-class, rational, highly educated metropolitan man with a young family who begins to have encounters with God. It's the first mainstream novel I've seen in a while to engage seriously with theological themes, and it's refreshing to read about a community traditionally hostile to religion, adapting to asking big questions. I'm halfway through and really loving it. I spoke to Neil about the book, about some of the autobiographical influences, and about what role the arts might play in building empathy across difference. Neil, thank you so much for coming in to speak to me at the Theosophist. Now, I'm going to ask you that knotty question that I'm asking everyone, often provokes a lot of thought. What do you hold sacred?
Well, I've given this a lot of thought because I'm aware that you've asked this question before on your podcast. The default answer would probably be love, in the same way as Francis Spufford defined love. But actually, I think it's actually forgiveness, because forgiveness interrupts, in a way, the world that I think love doesn't. And if one looks through essentially a lot of scripture, moments of forgiveness are key to how the world changes. And therefore, if we can see or experience ourselves as being able to forgive, I think we are aligned somehow with what our expectations of God might be. And so I feel that, I also feel it's much harder than we think it is. I also think forgiveness resonates through time in a way that nothing else quite does. In a sense, that would be my incomplete answer.
It's interesting looking at the tenor of our public conversations. One of the things this podcast is interested in is how we talk to each other in public, how lacking forgiveness is. We're seeing a huge amount of people being pilloried or shamed or rightfully criticized sometimes for things that have happened a very long time in the past. There doesn't seem to be a sense in which change is allowed or forgiveness can be proffered to those in public life.
Yes, I mean I think that's true. I think that I think we've almost got so far from any natural positive interaction that we're actually defaulting to shame, ridicule, mockery. That the idea of love and forgiveness seems to be, and often can be regarded as weakness, whereas actually that's where strength lies, because the direction of the conversation changes. It means that someone has had to have the strength to forgive. Someone has to accept that forgiveness, and in that action dynamic, there is a new space after that point. And so actually it takes an enormous amount of courage on both sides to create new spaces, because who's comfortable with new spaces? We're much more comfortable with our own rhetoric that is, that we've rationalized, that we make sense of, we believe is right. So the idea of opening up something where we are unsure, that's a radical stance these days.
And deeply unsettling. Francis Spufford, one of my earlier podcasts, talked about how the moment for him of deep failure, deep personal failure, of needing forgiveness, was a real turning point for him in terms of an openness towards the possibility of religious faith. So has forgiveness been, tell me about your personal journey with forgiveness.
Something did happen to me. I mean, actually, on a very minor level, but it was something I didn't feel if it did happen, I would ever be able to get over. And I remember it happening and feeling that, I mean, actually, this might sound like a contradiction, actually feeling that a person had essentially betrayed me, that I actually felt that it wasn't my place to blame. So in a sense, it wasn't quite forgiveness, but it wasn't my place to make a judgment about their behaviour. And in a sense, with that came forgiveness. And I don't think that is particularly a turning point in my life. I mean, actually, you know, my turning points, which I've written about, are sort of much more kind of vague or hazy. But it's certainly... And maybe it isn't. I mean, I often talk about Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, which a lot of people talk about, and the character of John Ames. And what I was thinking the other day about the extraordinary literary gift that Marilyn Robinson has given to us has created fiction of goodness and kindness. And people have always said that actually great drama and great fiction is we always actually engage with the bad people. We engage with, you know, it's the dynamism of almost of evil that we watch, you know, we're compelled by. But actually, Marilyn Robinson has created a fiction of goodness, gentleness, and kindness, and has made it deeply compelling, even for, you know, for atheists. I mean, you know, my most profound atheist friend thinks she's the, you know, the greatest living writer.
There was a famous review in the New York Times with a guy saying, you know, Marilyn Robinson makes me want to believe in God.
Yeah. And I think she was too. But for me, it was I felt I had to measure myself against John Ames, and I found myself lacking. And in finding myself lacking, I had to work out what that meant. And in a very important moment, I suddenly realized that I was lacking, and I couldn't find just within myself to make up the lack. And that required what I've often said is a sort of, you know, the excess of love that God has on offer, that you can petition for that and therefore be more loving. So that's why I would say my default answer would have been love. But actually, I think in a sense, that's a personal relationship. Actually, to make the relationship public, I think forgiveness is almost the kind of ultimate act of loving. Yes. Loving in a kind of golden rule sense of loving.
Yes. I want to come back to that because you've talked about it as at least in some way, some form of conversion experience. But I'd love to go wind back to the beginning of the story and hear a bit about the spiritual or religious or philosophical background of your childhood. What was in the air as you were growing up?
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. I come from a working class, South London family. The church was there at Christmas. Probably not even Easter. My mother has a kind of residual Scottish Calvinism about her.
Is that more temperament than theology?
Yeah. But absolutely declares herself as an atheist. My father is an interesting man in the sense that, from what I understand from his third wife, that when he was young, he actually did join a church, part of the boys' brigade. It was and believed and wanted to believe, but then he had a terrible accident in his late twenties, and his wife and child were killed, so he was widowed at 27, and interestingly enough, it's been he's basically said he has never, he says God doesn't exist because God would never have done that, and he, if God exists, he will never forgive God for doing that. And he, but he then did, once he then went and married a very devout Catholic, after my mother, and occasionally, you know, I mean, she's very devout. And would be involved with the church in the sense that, you know, he would know the priest and whatever, but would always claim categorically to be an atheist. But actually, that's got, in a sense, none of that was, you know, I didn't even know any of this when I was growing up. But no, I had no, you know, I mean, I think, we said the Lord's Prayer because it was a primary school in the 1970s. And quite frankly, I never understood what it meant. I started to read Dostoevsky very early. I was given Crime and Punishment about the age of 14 by my teacher, but actually it was not the Dostoevsky of Christianity that compelled me. It was more the kind of existential areas of Dostoevsky. So for a lot of my life, I was almost a kind of a classic existentialist atheist,
in a kind of Nietzschean,
yeah,
or
yeah, you know, we absolutely have to take sole responsibility for ourselves. We define ourselves by our actions.
Have you come across Jordan Peterson?
I have, and I it's extraordinary. I watched the now infamous interview, and then I started watching a lot on YouTube, and I just made a YouTube video because I have a YouTube channel talking about books on Jordan Peterson. Because I'm interested in how he's being represented and who he stands for and what he says he stands for, because he's a very complex and fascinating man. I usually get about 600 views on my very minor YouTube channel in about 5 days. I have had 6,000.
Yes, he does have a dedicated army of followers. Yeah.
But these have been very kindly... I mean, I wasn't particularly critical about him. I was saying, you know, I called it deconstructing Jordan Peterson. but I'm very interested in his, what I kind of call his kind of Augustinian view of life, the imperfectibility, the suffering, the fact that
I mentioned him because lots of Christians the more conservative leaning Christians, particularly in the States, are quite excited about him. Because he is using the G-bomb, you know, he's talking about God, yeah. and he obviously defends more socially conservative positions on things like gender. But he talks about being a cultural Christian, which always slightly raises my hackles. And I see much more of a Nietzschean, certainly in that rugged individualism comes through, that I think often gets conflated with Christianity and probably shouldn't.
I think that's true. And... I mean, I think I'm in a holding position at the moment, a holding pattern of belief I wouldn't know how to self-identify, really, apart from as not an atheist.
Yeah. Would you have called yourself an atheist at other points in your life?
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened between reading Dostoevsky as a 14-year-old and this encounter with John Ames in Gilead?
There was also Rowan Williams becoming Archbishop. I suddenly recognized a way of talking about the world that was my language, and therefore I felt a kind of kinship with someone. I was very excited. He's another deep Dostoevsky fan, but I remember, you know, listening to him and thinking, he's making sense to me. Yeah. You know, his language use is making sense to me. And therefore I could investigate, I don't know what happened. I think I've said the dial in me started to flicker, and I think it might have been Rowan Williams came before, Marilyn Robinson came before the death of a friend of mine at an early age at 39, and she had a humanist funeral in North London, and I was travelling back on the bus that they laid on to the And I was sitting on a bus on Holloway Road, and the sun was shining in, and it was hot. And she'd been buried in this, it was a big cemetery in North London, and she'd been buried sort of on the side of a path that looked just like a kind of piece of, you know, rural land. And I just had an experience of death not being, she left a 1-year-old child when she died, and I had young children at the time, and quite a lot of my fears, death leaving your children behind, she'd kind of gone through all of that, and I felt some kind of peace. At peace with myself, or that she was at peace, or that I'd misunderstood death as a limit to the, you know, the world. And so none of these things are particularly Christian, although obviously Romans are, that they are. One's about language, one's about love, one's about death.
The three ultimate things, possibly.
And you know, I could argue. I mean, one thing I could agree with Richard Dawkins about is maybe I'm a cultural Anglican, and when all of these things twitch, where am I going? What broader language am I going to use, other than one of the kind of, you know, Christian the language of Christians, and the language of St. Paul, and the language, all of those, that's going to be my default language. But I want to navigate it extremely carefully.
We're going to take a quick break to have a catch up with the Theos team. I'm here with Nathan Mladen in the Theos office. Nathan has been working on a project about debt. Tell me about it.
Hi, Liz. So yes, I am leading on a project on debt, which is run in partnership with the St. Paul's Institute. The project's called Forgive Us Our Debts, which obviously comes from the Lord's Prayer in the New Testament.
The King James Version.
That's correct. So you might be wondering, why are we doing a project on debt? You know, we're supposed to be the religion and society think tank, the Christian think tank. Why debt? Debt is one of the most pressing, complex issues of our age. In the UK in particular, things are pretty dire at the moment. Personal and household debt is very, very high. It is at levels unseen since the financial crisis, around 240 billion of credit card debt, loans and overdrafts. There are people really struggling with debt. 3 million, in fact, are in persistent credit card debt, with an average of £14,000.
£14,000 as an average?
That's the average. And in terms of government debt, things are no better. We're borrowing at wartime levels. The debt to GDP ratio is now 90%. Now, of course, yeah, that's the situation across the globe, but UK is particularly problematic with such a high level of debt. So just this situation alone would warrant at least kind of an interested response from us to look into this. But I think the reason why we're doing it is because the Christian scriptures and the Christian tradition have a lot to say on debt. In fact, the whole language of scripture is steeped in the language of finance and debt, forgiveness, redemption, giving an account. Even belief means to credit someone. So the language, the financial language, is actually woven through the scriptures, and the Old Testament in particular have a lot of detailed legislation on borrowing and lending, on interest rates, who could you charge interest to, and all the rest of it.
That stuff was written in an ancient Near Eastern society, right? The possibility of it being applicable to a globalized, fast-moving, fintech-steeped financial center down the road from us in London seems unlikely.
There's a huge chasm between that world and our world. But what we're trying to do is move the conversation around debt from looking at debt as simply an entity that has nothing to do with relationships, with the way we order our lives together in common, with questions of right and wrong sort of floating in the air, to a much more morally rich and relationally sensitive conversation about debt, which is ultimately about relationships and how we promise things to one another and how we think about the future and the ethical basis of those things. So we're trying to enrich that conversation and move things along so that people who are borrowing, people who are lending, can be attuned to the fact that we exist in relationships, and there is something to be said about the way we engage in these economic relations, aware of these moral and relational questions.
What you're saying is it's not just a practical economic question of what money's in what account. There's some big ideas there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of outcomes, we don't simply want to have deeper, better, richer conversations, but we also hope to make some kind of change possible, and obviously alleviate this persistent, debilitating forms of debt, while appreciating that, you know, not all debt is the same. Debt is a complex issue, but the kinds of debt that are known about and end up in the media are debts that really cripple individuals and break families. So those are the things that we're particularly concerned about.
And when will people be able to read the outcomes of this project?
We'll probably have something out by the end of the year, and we'll have some events culminating with a main event at the cathedral, at St. Paul's Cathedral, next year in 2019.
So let's come onto the book a little bit, and I'm halfway through, so no spoilers, please, and very much enjoying it. And what's really struck me is this central character having something of a conversion experience, an encounter with God, having his previous categories busted open amongst a group of people, a very default atheist, liberal, wealthy, highly educated, kind of, you know, tabloid shorthand of the metropolitan intelligentsia group of people, and their deep discomfort with that. Also, how many of them are sort of slightly intrigued, definitely unsettled by it. Has that been true in your own life?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's in a sense, it exactly reflects the when I was when people say, you know, what are you working on? I say, I'm working on a novel about a man who has an authentic encounter with God. That statement itself is freighted with complexity. I mean, encounter, and then you append authentic. It's what are you saying? And in a sense, you know, I've been brought up like, you know, much of my peers in on, you know, 20th century thinking, which is, you know, either so we've got, you know, you've got Freud or Jung, who will use certain psychological analytic tools to look at those kinds of experiences. And then there are, you know, the philosophers, you know, some talking about language as essentially being, you know, just descriptions of the world. Others saying that if you can't make sense of a sentence, it's because you can't sort out its truth claim, and you can't make a truth claim about something that you can't, you know, you can't falsify, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's, in a sense, that's my kind of cultural inheritance.
And I think most people who went through university in the, you know, the latter half of the 20th century would have that similar set of reference points.
But I wanted to ask the question, if someone claims an authentic experience with God, is there any way through to, let's say it's true. Let's just throw into the pot, it's true. So what do we then do with that? How? Because you can't say it. You can't make a persuasive case. All you can keep saying is it's true. Because everyone's going to go, yes, you think it's true, but it's about something else. And you just go into a feedback loop.
My husband calls them just-so stories.
Yeah. And so what I was interested in, and I think the novel is ultimately about, is that you can't because you can't make a persuadable case that the truth might be true, what are you left with? And you Wittgenstein would say you're pretty much left with silence. And that's not a bad place to end up, but it's not a very useful place, in the sense that no one really engages with the. I mean, there's quite a lot, maybe slightly later in the novel, about the mystical tradition and how, you know, it's all very well and good going into the desert and into silence and into a kind of deep relationship, but there is a wider world with suffering and difficulty, and silence is not much use to that. And so if silence doesn't work and you then can't do anything with language, where are we?
I think those twin threads towards kind of the solitude and the internal, but also out to others and into the community, is very integral to most people's experience of religion. And when you try and only do one, things can get a bit lopsided. We talk a lot here about how our debates about belief and unbelief tend to the rational, or at least an attempt to kind of club each other with arguments, which is, you know, not unique to that particular debate, when actually these things are very personal, very emotive. And we wonder a lot about how you can have a more authentically human engagement on them. And one sphere there with lots of potential is the arts. Have you found people reacting to your book are finding it easier to talk about the concept of God within the setting of a novel, or has there been hostility?
No, I mean, I was expecting hostility from both ends, in the sense I was expecting the sort of secular press to sort of go, this is, you know, we've done, this is done and dusted. Yeah. We've sorted this out. You're too late. And actually I thought the faith press would be slightly tougher on the fact that I'm perhaps more skeptical, or I don't align myself particularly with any faith, and therefore there are blasphemies in the broadest sense in the book. What I have felt is that there are people out there who I think that want to engage with these issues. They're not going to go to conferences, and they're not going to read nonfiction about these things, and they're not. They're not interested in soundbites. So the access point for them is the arts or storytelling, probably is more accurate. I think it was only published in late November. I had a great deal of, I suppose I mean the review in the Literary Review said my book had made theology urgent, hip, and even sexy. Well, I mean, you know, I couldn't have paid for that quote, because actually, in a sense, that's part of what I wanted to do. I want, you know, if the metropolitan elite lack theological sophistication, and they do, but they still want to pass judgment, then if one can make these things urgent, hip, and sexy, that's got to be a good thing. I feel that the conversations I have mean that I still, people are still defaulting to shorthand. This is a book about religion. It isn't, you know, or this is a Christian book. It isn't. It is trying somehow to broaden the conversation about what a encounter with God might feel like prior to the accretion of language. And, well, if I'm going to talk about it, so what happens the moment you say, I don't think, the moment you, someone says, well, what does that mean? You will start using language that has been appropriated by various religions, and then the conversation has just been hijacked. I do think people who don't necessarily want to self-identify as part of a particular religion have welcomed the novel's broader discussion of without just without really just kind of almost moving to spirituality on a kind of meaningless level. I mean, it uses the word God, and it's very clear that God, whatever that means, is present.
Yes.
It is not just a kind of meaningless spirituality.
Which is what's so refreshing for me, because I think because the concept of God is so mind-bending, hope-building, but also threatening for lots of us. And particularly, you've mentioned a moment of suffering in your father's life that led to him losing their faith. That happens to a lot of people, that actually there is a pain and a grief around an event bound up in how we think about God and a loving God, which means we're triggered when we talk about God. And therefore, we try and reduce conversations about religion and spirituality to practice, to communities, to social capital, all of which are fine and good things. But I find myself in very many settings going, "This, we are skirting the big stuff." You know, skirting the central question of these things. Yeah. And you don't have to come to a definitive answer, but we shouldn't avoid that big, hard thing at the heart of it. So I found it very refreshing. You've been thrust into these conversations about religion and non-religion, belief and non-belief through this book, I think probably more fully than you had been in the past. Why do you think it is so hard for us to have good public conversations about those things?
I think it's because to a certain degree, the conversations are polarized between the new atheists who have essentially hijacked the God word and dropped it on top of a subset of conservative Christian creationists and go, if you believe in God, you are like those. So that's one pole, and the other pole is will be people who self-identify as part of one religion, however liberal or however sophisticated. And so for someone whose natural access point is not my priest or my, you know, my pastor or my minister or whatever, and it's not fundamentalist atheism, what language and what space do we occupy to have a question and make mistakes and say, you know, I think I believe this, and I think, you know, or I'm not sure, you know, I want to believe this, but someone said this, and to be vulnerable to the difficult questions and know that they don't actually have to have answers. I think you're absolutely right. It's very hard. It's very hard to sort of to open yourself up and say, I believe in God, and someone go, you know, what about the massacre in Srebrenica? And you go, I don't know what to say to that. I mean, you know, that's its most simplistic level, but it's, in a sense, that's what it comes down to. And so what I think my view, and one of the reasons I felt when I was writing the book that I wanted to happen was that to create spaces where people can perhaps talk about their lived experience more than, and because McCulloch in my novel has a young family and he lots of things happen and he has to react to them emotionally. All of that is about the lived experience of being in the world. And if someone can, if you can have those conversations about characters, almost displace your own thing and kind of go, oh, that happened to him and he did that and what did that mean? And he post-rationalized this and, you know, but he still did these bad things and or what, then you can at least, you're at least having the conversations about, I mean, I think I once said, you know, the problem, the fact about fiction is it's both true and not true. And that's one of the paradoxes in a lot of how we believe things is you have to be open to those kind of complex, it's A and not A. Because that's how difficult these questions are. Yeah. That they are, there are two, there can be two right answers.
I've obviously thought a lot about Christian faith and theology, and have had various points in my life trying to be an atheist, and have come round to the fact that there is only one real hard question, and it is this suffering question. That most of the other intellectual objections to religious faith have some pretty convincing responses to them. But suffering is the real kicker for a lot of people. And at least part of the answer for me, and the reason I can hold that in my head, is about Christ, is about the cross, is about a moment of God entering into suffering, is the co-suffering of God, not as a kind of distant imposer of things, but someone who suffers alongside with us, understands it, but remains open to our freedom to make bad choices, essentially. In your book, the God, I can't call him or her a figure, the God character, the experience that McCulloch has of God is complex, isn't it? At one point, he soils himself after an encounter with God. It's not always benign, or perhaps often not benign. How have you engaged with the character of Jesus, which for a lot of people is the way into this more mysterious concept of the divine?
Yeah, I mean, I've given this lots of thought, and I don't know where I am. I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but it gets a lot worse than soiling himself, and he does approach directly Jesus on the cross. So in a sense, what he says at one point is that Jesus is on the cross for all time. And that's, in a sense, that makes that, for some reason, that what I mean, I have to say, I'm going to ramble, because there is something about Jesus's suffering that does make sense of our lives and suffering. It's the other. I mean, I've often been told that I can never be a Christian because I don't believe the tomb is empty, because I think actually the central image is Christ on the cross, or I will say Jesus on the cross. But also I can sort of almost agree with some people who think that it's a sort of almost a kind of perversion to meditate on that suffering at the same time. I'm a tragic Christian. I think life is essentially tragic, and there is no redemption as we normally conceive of it. That doesn't necessarily. I'm not necessarily talking about our relationship with God. I'm talking about our relationship with life, and that seems to me that makes sense to me with Christ on the cross. I know I'm not making any sense, but
these things are hard.
Yeah, but it's important. That's kind of all I've got. But I do. Suffering is not incompatible with God. It's compatible with free will, and free will is not incompatible with God. And once you start allowing for those things, it's never rational, but it doesn't necessarily mean it can't make sense to us.
I have been spotting in a few places the idea of God popping up in certainly recent publishing in a way that I hadn't seen over the last, 15 years, certainly. I think it was assumed that the glory days of Dostoevsky had passed, and since then we'd had Marilynne Robinson. Prior to that, we'd had Graham Greene. But other than that, big, serious literary engagement with the divine had passed. Do you have... I am a natural optimist. I have hope that might be changing. Do you feel that, or do you think this might just be a lonely road for you?
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I want tough arts that engage with this rather than, and so actually, that's, we're not going to have. I'm sort of not particularly interested in a sort of profusion of novels and arts about God, faith, and religion, unless they are really engaged and tough. Unless they're good, yeah. On the other hand, I there are certainly novels being written by people who have come from a religious background, who are not necessarily religious or now, but I'm thinking about Sarah Perry particularly, who's always talks about her direct influences being the King James Bible, and that's. And she comes from an evangelical background. Not entirely sure what she believes now, but she will keep those conversations going in a slightly different way, because she'll be talking about language and her past and whatever. And so
Sarah Perry wrote The Essex Serpent.
Yeah. So that's one thing. But actually, if you're going to talk about God and religion and faith, it better be tough. Otherwise it's not going to do any good, because you're just going to be, because the new atheists, and I know I kind of hate to bang on about this as one sort of, I said to people, but they are tough. Yeah. And they will come after you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you better be tough enough to defend yourself. Yeah. They're not coming after me, because I'm making, no impact whatsoever. But if I were to make an impact, yeah, they would come after me. Therefore, you've got to be tough.
It strikes me as something that is an important theme of the work that we do here, which is encouraging people of faith out from their kind of their bubbles, their places of safety, where they can talk in community-based language, to engage across these permeable barriers of belief and unbelief, to really hear. What are the things that other people hold sacred? How could we connect with them better? I'm really intrigued by your work that you do alongside writing novels of market research, and how people's implicit assumptions about things are often different from the things that they might state, the reasons that they might state for holding their beliefs. Do you think there is an opportunity to explore those areas, and what would be your hunch about what we might find about the different things that people believe?
Well, interestingly, the neurophilosophers all tend to be kind of hardcore atheists, but actually the neuroscience, it doesn't lead one to, in a sense that, what we know about kind of executive function, and we know that it's almost no point in asking us to self-report on our own emotions. Behavioral economics has basically said, we're not even going to give you the right, we think we're telling the truth, but we're not. We're making up a story that's quite easy for us to, we just kind of go, oh, I think I believe this. And you grab it out of air and it makes sense. It's kind of both, it's kind of rational and it feels right, but it won't necessarily be what you feel. The prefrontal cortex is made up of two bits. One is the emotional side, and one is the kind of executive rational side. And depending on, we tend to have feelings, and then we tend to try and make sense of them. And the moment we try and make sense of them, which we're not very good at doing, we rationalize ourselves. We can rationalize ourselves out of a feeling, but we're still feeling it. We've just, our descriptions are not very accurate. And so, the classic implicit association tests, when it talks about, how we self-report on, gender bias, on race, on all the complex issues, shows that we're not very good at. And the reason we're not, because we do mostly want to put our better selves publicly, and that's not necessary. And there's nothing wrong with having biases that come from how we've been brought up, our cultural life. We are going to be a mess of biases. To know what those biases are actually quite useful, because we don't necessarily want to have them, and we can use our executive function to make sure we don't implement them. But actually to ask people, you know, to self-report is often to let ourselves get away with easy answers and not particularly accurate ones. So I think both neuroscience and the methodologies that come out of neuroscience, I think, are going to tell us more about ourselves and the complexity of ourselves than necessarily the neurophilosophers essentially saying, you know, neuroscience is going to dispel God. Well, I don't think neuroscience is going to have anything to say about God ever, but it's going to have something to say about the context-dependent world that we live in. Means that we can't we will never quite know what it is we think and feel, and any expression of that will be, I think, somehow a reduction of the complexities of the self. And if we can allow people to, as I think we said earlier, to express themselves more vulnerably in places where they don't have to post-rationalize, then we will have it'll be a richer dialogue.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sacred. We'd really love to know what you think. You can get in touch via Twitter, which is @sacred_podcast, or email us at thesacredpodcast@gmail.com. We'd also love to ask a favour. If you're enjoying the series and you think it's important that we have big questions about difference, we'd love to enlist your help to spread the word. Please think about posting a review or rating us on iTunes or any other of your favourite podcast providers. Share on social media and tell your friends. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos or come to one of our Central London events, you can connect via our website at theosthinktank.co.uk.